How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for our new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
It is Locked On NBA. Kevin Pelton, ESPN insider awesomeness, is going to join us. We're going to run through his real plus minus projections for almost the entire NBA. We're going to talk about whether it's more important to have perimeter defenders or rim defenders. And we're going to talk about the guys most likely to become an all-star for the first time in this upcoming year. So that's all coming up on Locked On NBA today. Thank you so much for subscribing to Locked On NBA on iTunes or Android, whatever it might be. I'm David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz and founder of the Locked On Podcast Network. And I want to take a second to say thank you. And I want to thank a lot of people, so give me like 2 minutes here. First of all, I want to thank you, the listener, because your support of this program, the numbers have been great, and have allowed us to build out the Locked On Podcast Network, and you should now have a podcast for every NBA team and every NFL team. We're short five of each. I really feel confident we're going to get it done and get everybody on there for you. So if you please just take a big thank you, subscribe to your favorite team. If it's Locked On Jazz, I'm there for you. If it's Locked On one of these other teams, grab it. Every NBA team should be up by about September 15th is the hope. So and that would not have happened without you. Locked On NFL has Matt Williamson hosting a daily NFL show that's just terrific. There's also, by the way, a Locked On Fantasy Basketball show with Josh Lloyd that's really good. So make sure you grab, and he did Nate Duncan this week, which was super. So make sure you subscribe to those. And there's Locked On NFL for each and every team. Now, the other group I want to thank is those early sponsors that made this possible. Locally in Utah, there were a few of them. Larson Digital Media is actually a national company that they do digital media transitions for you. They do, you know, they take like your movie film and put it to DVD or your old slides and so that your video doesn't degrade over time. They do great work. They're converting everything to digital for you. I want to thank them. They were early on, big supporter. So thank you to Larson Digital Media for that. Their website's LarsonDigital.com. University of Utah MBA Online Program was an early supporter. I thank them tremendously. You could check them out. I also really am thankful to locally Devin Cash Real Estate jumped aboard. So there have been just a bunch of really good people. We've got some new sponsors that are coming on a national level. Mack Weldon sponsored, and I'm so thankful for that because then I found out about Mack Weldon and I've become completely addicted to their Pima t-shirts, which I guess aren't even expensive in this day and age. They are fabulous. You can still get 20% off using the promo code LOCKED on that. Casper Mattresses, same deal. Use the promo code LOCKED. SeatGeek was one of our first sponsors, and they've been so great to buy a sponsorship of the entire Locked On Podcast Network. Use the promo code LOCKED and get a $20 rebate. So thank you to all of you, most of all to you for listening to the program. If you hadn't tuned in, you hadn't bought in, we wouldn't be able to build this out. It's been great. That's enough from me. Let's go to Kevin Pelton. This is what you want. It's Locked On NBA with Kevin Pelton. Send him a thank you at K Pelton like we always do. All right, you have to open the interview, Pelton, by being totally honest. What's more fun for you? Projection, real plus minus, that kind of stuff, or actual analysis of things that have happened?
I think the appetite among NBA fans now is greater for what might happen than what actually will happen. It's still not quite the same looking at the results of the RPM in my spreadsheet as it is actually watching games played. So I am still going to have to go with that.
All right, let's talk about it. There's a bunch of things we'll talk about. I have a defensive question for you. You've got a huge project. You're the guy to read right now. If you're an NBA fan desiring news, there's nobody better than Pelton right now. Let me just kind of run through something that's about to be released, and then we'll talk about stuff that is going to release. You have for the last few years done player profiles. I believe it was over fried chicken and waffles at the screen door that you asked me what would I do what you were kind of debating. We were brainstorming on what you were going to do with it this year. What it starts here shortly, so everybody wants all the player profiles of the NBA. Go to Kevin at ESPN.com. What have you decided to do? What will be the format of player profile this year?
Well, this was actually, I'm pretty sure, over Shake Shack in Las Vegas that we had this conversation.
All right. Sorry, you and I have eaten too many meals together.
Yeah, you're learning a little funny about our eating habits in this portion of the conversation. But, no, I mean, I think it's really going to be the team previews that come out in October that will probably have a little bit different look this year than in past years. The player profiles, that format is pretty good and well-established. It actually dates back to, obviously, John Hollinger originated all of this, my predecessor at Insider. Going back to, I keep handy the original Pro Basketball Prospectus from 2002-03, and it evolved from that when he started at ESPN Insider, started doing these profiles. Then Bradford Doolin and I started doing our own version of the Pro Basketball Prospectus book in 2009 with very similar profiles. And then when we came to Insider, just kind of ported those on over and have been doing them there for the last 4 years now.
I have Pro Basketball Prospectus 2009 and 10 right in front of me. Would you like me to read you from it?
What's the random page you're going to find?
I don't know.
There?
I should find some random page. It's almost illegal to do this to you, to find a random page of something that was written in the 2009-10 book and see what absurdities I can find. I probably should go to the Utah Jazz. C.J. Miles. Miles has found his offense role as his usage and shot selection have remained remarkably consistent. Yeah, that's the only thing about him that was consistent. He gave back some of the shoot that he didn't write that. That was me. He gave back some of the shooting games from 07-08, but has established a nice baseline as an efficient shooter, not as athletic as you'd think. He doesn't draw enough fouls and is a poor rebounder for his size. Miles is a capable defender as he often tag teams with Ronnie Brewer and Andre Karolinko when the Jazz comes up against premier wing scorers. Shoney forecasts a replacement level season, which is a good starting point for a player who in another era would just be starting his rookie season in the NBA.
Well, I think that holds up pretty well, other than the fact that it's Shaney, not Shoney. But that actually was Bradford Doolittle who wrote that one. I'm pretty sure he had the Jazz the first year or two.
Oh, all right, so I couldn't get you. Oh well. Anyway. But anyway, that's just kind of a fun little game to play. So that's coming out. Player profiles are coming out. You did a nice piece today on future All-Stars. But let's get to the main reason we're having you on. Real plus minus has really become one of your favorite things. It has been and is becoming, in many people's mind, the premier way to forecast teams. I thought there's some interesting things because I've been using my PAC system to forecast, and actually some of our stuff came out surprisingly similar in some ways. So I thought that was interesting. So let's break down a little bit. First off, let's go back for those that are new. Why do you like what is the premise behind Real Plus Minus, and why do you like it so much?
So what I like about Real Plus Minus is that it's in some ways kind of a marriage between the two different schools of how you evaluate players statistically. One of those is, of course, you start with the box score and you value everything that a player does either positively or negatively. And then adjusted plus minus is this entirely different perspective where you say, hey, what happened when this player was on the court? Once we control for the teammates that were out there with him and the opponents who he was playing against, you know, how much did he actually help the team with his performance? You know, not caring whether it's tracked in the box score or not, basically. So that's adjusted plus minus, which in theory is the best possible metric because of the fact that you don't have to worry about making assumptions. You don't have to worry about hometown scorers who give more assists to one player than, you know, a visiting player. All of these issues that come up with box score stats aren't a problem for adjusted plus minus. Except that because of the fact that, you know, there are actually relatively few lineup combinations. For example, if you've got two guys who split minutes at center and they don't really overlap with other players, there's consistent rotations, it's really tough for adjusted plus minus to tell, well, is it because, you know, does the team play worse with the backup center on the court because he's bad, or is it because the other guys around him aren't as good? So real plus minus grows out of, you know, kind of a synergy of these two schools, from Jerry Engelman, who has done a lot of great work on Justin Plus Minus, and also Steve Ilardi, who has done the same. And basically, the way it works is it starts with the assumption that your is good is your individual stats, and we value those individual stats based on how well they project adjusted plus minus over a whole bunch of different players. And then we adjust from that starting point based on what actually happened with players on and off the court. And that way we get a more consistent value from year to year. No, still not a completely consistent one. And then also, one big key is the version of Real Plus Minus that you see on ESPN.com is year to year. The version that I'm using in these projections is a multi-year version considering the last 3 years and taking them into account, so you get a larger sample size, less noise in the data from that. And then, like you said, these projections have done very well, generally speaking. Did really well on team over-unders from Las Vegas last season. And the projections that have generally won the competition on the APBR Metrics Advanced Stats Forum are kind of variants of plus-minus that are in a similar realm to RPM, but not exactly the same.
Well, that sucks, because I was, just because we're close friends, I wasn't giving you some candy-ass interview here, and I was going to ask you some tough question next about the flaw of Real Plus Minus, but you just brought it up and answered it already. That's no fun.
It's the B-Rabbit strategy.
It is. The one, I have resident geeks I talk to, too. Hopefully they're listening. I mean that with loving affection when I call you that. Who their complaint is that sometimes players real plus minus varies too much season to season for their liking. And your comment on that is what?
No, I think it's completely fair. And that's part of, again, why we use the multi-year version when we're predicting going forward instead of the year-to-year version, which is still life, because sometimes you do see guys really have changes in their ability. And when you look at the multi-year version, like, you can tell that it's not as sensitive to those real changes in their performance as the year-to-year version is. But if you're looking forward, definitely the way to do it is to consider multiple years of data. And, you know, obviously there's still going to be some noise in that. You can't reduce it entirely. But I think the fact that it has predicted relatively well is an indication that it's doing a pretty good job of picking up on that. You know, even it helps the teams generally stay constant season to season. But even when we see, you know, fairly big turnover, last year's Portland Trailblazers were a good example, a team that almost completely turned over its starting lineup, and RPM had them at 40 wins, which seemed crazy before the season until they went on to win 44.
All right, so that's enough of the geeky stuff. People are going to fall asleep. So let's go to it. When you ran it through your computer, the two biggest surprises to you in each conference were what? Let's start with the West. When you did this, the biggest surprises to you were what in the Western Conference?
I guess maybe the Memphis Grizzlies being below 500 would maybe be the biggest one. Either that or the Clippers at 46 wins, which is a lot less than I had them paid for subjectively.
All right, let's jump in. My system also has the Grizzlies really struggling. I don't have them as a very efficient offensive team, and they're getting old, so it's hard to believe they'll be as good defensively. Why was it surprising to you?
Yeah, and that one, like I say, it wasn't quite as surprising. It's more based on the conventional wisdom. What happened is, you know, we talked about these player profiles. I did the Memphis one, you know, a couple weeks ago, and I started going through and really looking at their rotation, and you see a lot of question marks on that second unit. So even though I think the starting lineup is going to be better with Chandler Parsons, now you've got a lot of injury risks with Parsons coming off knee surgery, Marcus Gasol coming off the broken foot, Mike Conley missing time due to injuries, and, you know, is into his late 20s. I don't think you can expect him to play all 82 games. And you look at their backup point guards, they've got a rookie, Wade Baldwin, and Aaron Harrison coming up from the D-League. Those two guys, or Andrew Harrison, I should say, coming up from the D-League. Those two guys backing up Conley. If he goes out, I think that's going to be a major issue for them. Their shooting guard rotation, you know, Tony Allen is into his mid-30s, generally misses some time due to injuries. And behind him, you have Vince Carter, who's 39, and Troy Daniels, who has never managed to hold down a consistent rotation spot throughout his career. So you look at those positions, I think those are, and then James Ennis, a small forward, who, you know, had an encouraging finish to the season last year in New Orleans when he got a chance to play, but still not someone who we've seen in rotation over a full season. So not a lot of proven reserves outside of the front court for Memphis.
All right, so the Clippers you have going from 52 wins last year in a year where they went for much of the year without Blake Griffin to 53 last year to 46 this year. Why would this Clipper team possibly lose seven more games than it did a year ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main reason for that would be just general age. They're one of the older teams in the league. And, you know, in particular, they're starting backcourt with Chris Paul and J.J. Redick. Those guys have managed to defy aging to some extent so far. Redick had probably the best season of his career last year. And Paul, you know, hasn't lost much from his prime yet as he's gone into his 30s. And I think, you know, if those two guys fall off, it could be a little more difficult for them to you know, overcome a potential absence from Blake Griffin, who has missed a lot of time in the last couple of seasons.
Do you really believe that one?
No, I still think they're probably the third best team in the West.
So the Houston Rockets on my PAC system come out very strong. And my system is obviously only offensive-based, but it has them as really, obviously, the Warriors are through the roof. And then it, I think, had them, I don't have it in front of me, either the second or third best offensive team in the Western Conference. And at some point, that probably makes them the second or third or fourth best team offensively in the NBA. You win a lot of games if you're top five, either offensively or defensively. What do you see on where the Rockets are?
Yeah, RPM has them fifth offensively, and I think that's pretty reasonable when you look at the fact that there's a lot more shooting now around James Harden with Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson, and you know they're going to space the floor more than they did last year, where they played a lot of the time with even two 7-footers on the court with Capella and Howard. And you put that in D'Antoni's system, it looks like this is going to be a really good offense. It also might be an equally atrocious defense because of those changes.
So the two biggest surprises to me in your Western Conference real plus minus was Denver at 8 with a 6-win increase from last year, and Dallas falling off the table. Let's discuss, and maybe just because I can't imagine Dallas not being good. They've been good for so long. Let's start with that. What is it? Why are we believing that Mike Malone and Denver are about to make such a significant push?
You know, they've accumulated just a lot of quality depth with how well they've drafted the last few years. They've got, you know, two perhaps starting quality centers in Nikola Jokic, who actually had the best RPM among all centers last year in the single year version, and then Jusuf Nurkić, who missed a lot of last season and wasn't the same player due to injuries. They get Wilson Chandler back, who should help them a bit on the wing and kind of pushes some of the really low RPM guys that they had playing minutes late last season, like you know, Jakar Sampson and Mike Miller in the limited heat minutes he got, pushes those guys down in the rotation because of the fact that you have Chandler back healthy. And then just the internal development of your young guys, Moutier, Gary Harris. I don't know that Jokic can play much better, but I guess he's in that category as well. So, you know, RPM sees a pretty deep team, you know, with a couple options at pretty much every position.
Emmanuel Moutier was the second worst offensive player in the NBA and the worst returning offensive player in the NBA, according to my numbers last year, and i.e. Kobe Bryant is gone. What does real plus minus see out of Emmanuel Moutier this year?
Well, that he can't possibly be that bad again, I guess. And he did improve a lot over the course of last season. That's not necessarily something that RPM is going to factor for and probably shouldn't, because historically it hasn't necessarily translated into additional improvement in future years. But, you know, he started to come on as a shooter, I think, at 37% of his threes after the All-Star break last year. And, you know, he's not, I don't think, going to be anywhere close to an average starting point guard this year. But, you know, he might have been number 30 in the league last year, number 29, and I think he can do better than that this year.
Most people saw, what's your thought on why Dallas is just, you just have Dallas, you have Dallas 13th. Like, you have rebuild. What's your thought on what's going on there?
Another year older for a lot of their key players, you know, and then a downgraded small forward from Chandler Parsons to Harrison Barnes. They're really betting on Barnes being able to improve in a different role. You know, I think a lot of the what we term the Rick Carlisle effect is really just about Dirk Nowitzki's ability to space the floor and get guys good looks in the pick and roll that way. But Barnes, can't really run the pick and roll, so I don't see him deriving that benefit. And I think he's probably going to be more or less the same player he was in Golden State, except making the max.
You have Utah as third. I think we've not talked about that yet. I think most people read this, and that was the stunner. I would guess that for most fans across the country, when they got this and they said, okay, you project the Warriors to win 67 and the Spurs to win 54. Utah, why is Utah third? I think that in itself, that the Clippers were not three, that Utah was three, that to me, I would guess, is one of the biggest surprises if you're a fan seeing this. How is that possible?
Yeah, people have a hard time wrapping their minds around that. And I think it's largely because of the fact that they're looking at Utah as this 40-win team that wasn't good enough to make the playoffs last year, whereas advanced stats are looking at them as a team that had the fifth-best point differential in the Western Conference, ahead of four teams that made the playoffs, including the Portland Trail Blazers. And so starting at the baseline of a 46-win team as opposed to a 40-win team, and then adding on top of that, getting Exum back, adding George Hill, you know, I think is probably driving the biggest increase in that in the RPM standpoint, but also Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw. So all of that, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think they're the third best team in the West. As I mentioned, I still think the Clippers are probably belonging in that spot, but I do think they're number four, and I think a solid favorite to have home court advantage in the West.
So wait a second, you're viewing them as a 46-win team, so you actually think all the moves they made only make them a win and a half better?
Well, you're still going to have some regression to the mean built into that. So, you know, you can't quite compare past wins to projected wins in that same way. But, yeah, it actually probably is less about the offseason moves they made and more about the fact that they were just a better team last year than their record indicated.
Who on the Jazz is better in real plus minus than people realize?
You know, I mean, I think most of the guys who drive their RPM are the guys who get most of the credit as a – you know, Rodney Hood has never rated quite, or no, I guess in RPM he does. I'm sorry, that's in the box score stats. He doesn't fare as well. So not really anyone, I think, who's tremendously surprising. Like, I guess the one guy would be Jeff Withey, who had really impressive RPM numbers last year in his limited minutes off the bench.
To me, what the Jazz have done, and I'm a huge believer in this, I think you are too. I don't know if we've ever discussed this. One of my things is just, particularly on offense, just have all your players be above average offensive players. Like, if the Rockets could just get rid of Corey Brewer, I think I have them, like, I mean, I really think they're remarkable. Every one of their players then is an above average offensive player on their roster. The Jazz add an above average offensive player in George Hill and get rid of a below average offensive player, Trey Burke, and Howell Netto was right at average in my systems. Trey Lyles has to just improve. Chris Johnson was below. Shelvin Mack was below for the season. Elijah Millsap and J.J. O'Brien, and they replaced them with above average. How important is it, and how much does this system, maybe even talking about last year's Boston, just believe in having above average players at each of your rotation spots?
You know, I mean, it's nothing that specific, of course, because of the fact that, you know, it's just additive. If you have one superstar and three below average players, that can be as valuable as having four above average players. But, you know, I think that is a formula to get there if you don't have that superstar. I mean, I guess the one question here is whether Dante Exum is going to be anywhere near average offensively for the Jazz this year.
Yeah, or the crazy one that I like to bring up and then just start giggling over in the corner is whether he becomes well above average.
In that case, look out.
Right. Like, that's the crazy scenario, right? If he becomes above average. Now, that draft class has been anything but, though, right? The vaunted draft class has not, right? I often think, look around what everybody's doing around him to figure out what he might do. The guys around him have not exploded on the scene yet.
Although I think there were a lot of guys that played a lot better in year two from that class than in year one.
Some.
Jabari Parker is maybe the most interesting example, because he's someone who kind of went through the same process where, you know, the first half of the season last year, he wasn't very good coming off that ACL injury, hadn't been great as a rookie, and then kind of exploded in the second half of the season offensively.
All right, let me just run through some Western Conference things before we jump into the East. San Antonio Spurs without Tim Duncan. What's the impact of the loss of Duncan?
Yeah, likely to be a big drop-off defensively. Duncan actually had the best RPM on a per-possession basis defensively in the league, ahead of Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi contributed more total value because he played a lot more minutes, but that's going to be hard to replace, especially, you know, Pau Gasol has his issues defensively as a center, never forces turnovers. His teams tend to struggle on the defensive glass with him at center. So you look at all of that, and I think, you know, there's a chance for them to be better offensively than they were last season, but possibly take a step backwards. You know, they've got a lot of room to give defensively since they were number one in the league by a pretty wide margin, but I don't see them repeating that.
The Oklahoma City Thunder lose Kevin Durant. How does this remix Thunder look to you via Real Plus Minus? When he led them, they did not make the playoffs in that Durant injured year. You think this team is better than that and able to make the playoffs?
I think they are better than that, but I think the big key is, you know, that year it took 45 games to make the playoffs. They won 45, I think, and didn't make the playoffs, which is a huge difference from last year when 45 would have gotten you the fifth seed and the chance to play the Clippers and potentially get to the second round of the playoffs like Portland did.
Why, if Anthony Davis is so good, is New Orleans still going to hover right around 37 wins all over again?
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, by RPM, Davis hasn't been quite as good as, you know, the reputation. He really started to stand out in RPM in 2014-15 when they did make the playoffs. You know, the second half of that season was almost certainly his best defense he's played in his career. And last year he took a big step backwards in that regard. And it's tough to say how much of that was, you know, just a lack of motivation. So weak at the center position with Omer Asik as a starter there. That's a major drain on you. They lose a lot of shooting with Gordon and Anderson going to Houston. I think they will be a lot more competitive defensively though this year with you know, the guards that they've brought in, and just losing those two guys helps them defensively.
All right, and Los Angeles Lakers. The Timothy Mozgov is not going to change who they are.
Sadly, does not appear so. Yeah, I projected them after they signed Luol Deng in the first week of end of free agency. And at that point, I had them at 26 wins, and they ended up settling at about 25, which is the lowest projection for anyone. Although, you know, Philadelphia is right there as well, and it's within the margin of error whether they actually end up with the league's worst record. But they're not likely to be substantially better than last year.
We can do the Eastern Conference now. You realize we did that whole West though, and I never really dug into the Warriors.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think everyone is so convinced they're going to be at the top that it's sometimes hard to find things to talk about with them.
And is there anything by not talking about them? Like, are they just so great that it's stunning to you? Do they just come out exactly as you'd think? Are they maybe not as great? Like, do you have any vibe of where you'd put them compared to what we'd think of this? Like, if you compare them and the, as they sit today, and the Cavaliers, who are clearly going to be number one on your Eastern Conference, what is there anything in that regard that says to you, ooh, that's eye-opening, or are they exactly where everybody thinks they are?
Well, I mean, I think Cleveland's RPM projection coming in a little lower than expected says something. But, you know, Golden State, they're projected for 68 wins, which it doesn't sound like very much when you're coming off a 73-win season and 167 in the championship the year before. But part of the nature of projection systems is they're very conservative because, you know, we know that some teams are going to win, you know, 55-plus games, let's say, to pick an arbitrary benchmark. But we don't necessarily know which teams it's going to be. There's a 20% chance it's, you know, this team, and a 20% chance it's this team, and a 20% chance it's another team. And one of those in the specific season we end up playing will jump up into that group. So basically, you're generally going to have projections pretty close to around 500, generally speaking, to try to make them as accurate as possible. So for the Warriors to be at 68, that's two more than anyone else has gotten in the 7 years for which I've gone back and done RPM projections. So they're kind of in a league of their own, I would say, in terms of where they're projected going into the season.
When you do these projections, are you building in injuries at all, or is that just age? Is that just age regression?
So the way that injuries are factored in is that, you know, I look at the games that players have missed over the previous three seasons. And everyone is projected to miss a minimum of six games right off the top, just because of, you know, the randomness of a sprained ankle or, you know, something like that, or an illness over the course of the season. And then you kind of take away from there with guys who have the track record of injuries. So with a team like the Warriors, where they, you know, their star players mostly stayed healthy during the regular season, contrast that with the playoffs with Steph Curry, but, you know, Curry, Thompson, Draymond Green were on the court, you know, 79, 80 games last year. So that's going to pull them back a little bit, just the assumption that everyone is going to miss some time due to random injuries.
All right, let's do the same question I asked you about the West. When you ran your numbers on Real Plus Minus, what were the two biggest surprises to you about the Eastern Conference?
Atlanta being below 500 certainly would be one of them, I think. I'm not sure beyond that. I know a lot of people will look at that New York number where they are as being surprising, but
they're a super
so
team.
Different from what I think. Derek Rose certainly is going to be surprised by it, but I don't know if it's so far off from where I had them subjectively.
All right, let's talk about those two teams and dig in. What's your thought on Atlanta? Why Atlanta comes in after they were a 60-win team. They dropped to, what were they last year, about 47? 47? I don't have it in front of me. But they were still pretty darn good. And now you have down to 39. Why do you have such a dramatic fall for Atlanta?
You know, I think this is one that RPM just doesn't get them. Even last year in the second half, when they had emerged as, you know, the number two defense in the league behind San Antonio, pretty clearly at that point the third best team in the Eastern Conference over the second half of the regular season, and RPM was still saying they had around 500 true talent. So I think the fact that guys like, you know, Kent Bazemore, I guess would be the primary one at this point, guys like him, you know, maybe even players like Tim Hardaway Jr., you know, they had such bad track records before they got to Atlanta and enrolled in Hawks University. I think that's one factor that's maybe holding them back. So, you know, I would add a couple of wins mentally to that one, at least. I think they're certainly going to be an above 500 team, and I don't think that, you know, Al Horford for Dwight Howard, I think, is a downgrade for them, but it's not, you know, enough of a downgrade to push them from the third seed to out of the playoffs, in my mind.
What is it about Hawks University that makes these players better?
Well, they start shooting a lot better, for one thing. And, you know, in the case of someone like Hardaway, who could already shoot, in his case, it was getting it at the defensive end of the court so he could at least contribute a little bit over the second half of the season. So now they're doing that with a couple of rookies in DeAndre Bembry and Torian Prince, who, you know, we'll see how much they contribute right away. That's probably more likely a year or two down the road for those guys.
All right, and your second one was the Knicks, only because maybe everybody else is real. So why are the Knicks so bad? They're 35 wins. They've got Derrick Rose. They've got Carmelo. They seemingly have put together some sort of a roster here. They got their center and Joakim Noah. Why do you have the Knicks as the third worst team in the Eastern Conference?
Oh, they put together some kind of roster, all right. The big issue, I think, is that people are still looking at Rose as this guy who, you know, any minute now it's going to click for him and he's going to get back to, you know, if not where he was when he won MVP in 2010-11, at least, you know, the player we saw flashes of in the 2015 postseason when he had some really good games for Chicago. And it turns out that those games almost exclusively are tied to when he has 2 days of rest, which you're not always going to have during the regular season. When he plays back-to-back, or when he plays even on this, you know, kind of standard one-day rest, he's not a very effective player, and overall he's been about a replacement-level player since he came back from the injury. So that's I think, a big factor between the subjective perception of the Knicks and where any statistical projection is going to see that. The other one is, and you have some injury risks with Rose. Carmelo Anthony has missed time. Obviously, Noah has missed a lot of time, had the shoulder surgery last year. And there's not a ton of depth on this team because of the fact that they used all their money in free agency to fill out the starting lineup with Noah and Courtney Lee. So behind them, you know, at point guard, they do have a pretty good backup in Brandon James, but no third point guard on the roster right now. That guy's going to have to emerge in training camp, and you'd expect someone to see playing time at that position given Rose's history and the fact that Jennings is also still only, you know, in a couple of years removed from rupturing his Achilles.
So
in the front court, they went overseas with Mindaugas Kuzminskas and Vili Hernan Gomez. Either of those probably are going to be quality reserves. And Lance Thomas, you know, shot 40% from three-point range. It was pretty good reserve last year. But if he slips back to the shooter that he was beforehand, you know, if he's down to somewhere in the low 30s, then, you know, he's not going to be very effective either.
All right, so we have what you said. We joke they put together some kind of a roster. A few teams did that in the East. Chicago yeah. did that. Orlando did that. I'd say Indiana did that. I mean, there were really mysterious moves. And you don't have any of them winning 40 games this year.
No, which is not unique in the Eastern Conference, since it doesn't figure to have a really strong, you know, I guess, third tier, fourth tier. I'm not sure which group that is. But, you know, a below 500 team might end up making the playoffs. More likely one of those teams will rise out of it. But, yeah, Chicago, very similar to New York, where you've got a lot of injury risk. You've got players, in their case, who really don't seem to fit together. And then I think the big question with the Bulls, from a statistical standpoint, is going to be their defense. You bring in Rondo, who didn't play any defense last year, Wade, who takes a lot of plays off, and you don't have the rim protection of Noah. They struggled defensively after he underwent that shoulder surgery last year. This could get ugly for them defensively.
So Orlando's the mystery team. I'm not sure anybody quite understands what they just did. What's your take? Is there a numerical answer to what they did that made sense?
No, I mean, you know, individual moves maybe made sense. I think, you know, Bismack Biyombo is a backup center, is pretty good. $18 million is a lot for him to play backup center for you. You know, Serge Ibaka has not been the same player the last couple of years, and it is not really expected to bounce back, but I think they're optimistic that a larger offensive role will help him have more energy at the defensive end. But then you look at, you know, Jeff Green for $15 million, where does he fit in this roster? Aaron Gordon's probably sliding out to small forward, where his shooting is going to be a minus, and they already have a non-shooter at point guard in Alfred Payton, so how do they space the floor? And, yeah, I mean, I think that they might be somewhat better from last year, but hard to see them really jumping up into playoff contention.
You have 5 through 12 in the Eastern Conference separated by 5 wins.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure what the question is. I just am kind of stunned by it. Now, is that just because a projection system naturally keeps teams close together? Or is this just the biggest mush pot of average teams? I mean, is this competitive balance at its worst?
I mean, you know, that's part of it. And it's interesting that those teams are all within the margin of error, because the average error for RPM projections is around 6 wins when you start to factor in all the things that, you know, A, we can't pick up on statistically, and B, you just can't project because they're random, whether it's injuries or in-season trades or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think all of those teams have a chance to make the playoffs, but none of them maybe, you know, other than the very top of that group, are maybe more than 50% likely to do so.
So that leaves Detroit, Toronto, Boston, and Cleveland. Cleveland, we've talked about. Boston makes the big move over the offseason for Al Horford. How close is Boston to Cleveland?
I don't think that close, even though they come out fairly close in the RPM projections. I mean, part of that is a fairly conservative minutes allocation for the Cavaliers. They're able to ramp up the minutes of LeBron in particular in the playoffs and, you know, play a lot better lineups. And they've just been a dramatically different team in the playoffs, and I see no reason for that to change, even though, you know, Matthew Dellavedova, who they lost, was an RPM favorite, especially at the defensive end. Boston and Toronto is an interesting competition for second in the Eastern Conference. You know, last year, RPM had Boston projected second with 48 wins, and they ended up exactly nailing that 48-win projection, but still finished as high as the third because of the fact that Toronto so dramatically outperformed. I don't know if they'll do that again because, you know, Kyle Lowry's another year older, and they're really very dependent on him, but you know, we'll see. They're right there in the mix, and I like the Jared Sullinger signing for them a lot.
You like the Jared Sullinger signing?
I mean, why? At that money, they couldn't reasonably have done any better. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, I don't know how much he'll be able to play power forward next to Jonas Valanciunas, but I think, you know, he can replace Biyombo as their backup center, and very different stylistically, obviously, in that role. But you know, he has consistently had good advanced stats, despite, you know, not looking as good perhaps on the court.
So there's a bunch of coaching changes that are interesting. Scott Brooks, I think, pretty good coach. I know a lot of people don't, but I think he's a pretty good coach. Takes over in Washington. Tom Thibodeau, who is recognized universally as a pretty good coach, takes over in Minnesota. How do you adjust for those type of changes in your system?
I don't. I mean, Shaney had some factors that kind of regressed teams that changed coaches towards the mean defensively, which, you know, I think is, in the case of someone like Minnesota, a pretty accurate thing, because you know that with Thibodeau, you're going to get much better shot defense than they had the last couple of years when they were, you know, a bottom-tier defense in the league. But it's not an RPM at all. So Minnesota is an example of a team that I think is overwhelmingly likely to outperform their projection as a result of it, because they're pegged for 27th in defense, and there's no way Tom Thibodeau is coaching a 27th-ranked defense.
So then if that's the case, you have the Minnesota really even is a playoff team.
I think that's very possibly the case.
So, all right, let's go back to Minnesota here for a second. You have Minnesota floating around 11th, I believe. You have Denver sitting at 8th as a playoff team. Which of those teams do you really think is the playoff team when you encounter the fact that Thibodeau is involved?
Oh, Minnesota for sure, I think. You know, I think I might still have teams like New Orleans and Memphis is more likely to make the playoffs than Denver. And I think that's really reflecting more that they're likely to just be a lot more competitive than people are thinking.
How many teams in the Eastern Conference, how many teams in the Western Conference do you think are better than, we'll stop at Washington. So the Washington, Charlotte, Milwaukee, Indiana, Atlanta, Miami, Chicago, Orlando mushpot that floats between 36 and 41. How many teams in the West do you think are better than those teams?
I would say at least 6 and maybe all 8 playoff teams.
And you wouldn't include New Orleans there?
No, I wouldn't say that they're better than them.
And you wouldn't?
I think they're in a similar spot.
You wouldn't include Denver, or you would?
Would not include Denver.
But you would include Minnesota?
Yes.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, let's talk about a few other things. So I'm reading Zach Harper, who did a nice little piece the other day about rim protection. I'm reading your stuff recently, and the bunch of stuff comes together, and I say to myself, wait a second. The best defenses in the NBA last year were possibly, I could make the argument, more important that they had wing defenders than they had rim defenders. Anything to this? San Antonio's got Kawhi and Danny Green. Atlanta's got a pressing outside defense, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, they don't really have a true rim protector.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's always been an interesting question, because there's sometimes people conflate better with more important. So let me unpack that. Obviously, we know that there's a spectrum defensively where point guards contribute less defensive value, generally speaking, than shooting guards. Shooting guards contribute less than small forwards. Small forwards than power forwards, and then centers contribute the most defensive value. But that's not necessarily an indication that centers are the most important part of a defense. I mean, if you look at it from a real plus-minus standpoint, you know, you can predict it pretty well using, as I do, just an additive formula where you add up the defensive RPMs of the different players who are going to be on the court. So in that standpoint, if you've got a point guard who is 3 points better than the average point guard defensively, that's just as valuable as a center who is 3 points better than the average defensively, even though the center's defensive RPM is going to be much higher than the point guard's defensive RPM. So what you're really interested in is the distribution of those. And there was a piece that looked at this on Nylon Calculus a few years ago. I have to tweet this out after you post the podcast, because I don't recall the author off the top of my head. But you know, they found that there is a slightly larger distribution as well defensively at center than there is, for example, at point guard, but it's not an enormous difference in those two.
All right, so let me go to Utah Jazz.
More important.
Let me go to Utah Jazz because this is what I understand. So last year the Jazz had 6'1" point guards in Raul Neto and Trey Burke, who while Neto was okay, he was still so small. This year they go to 6'3" with a 6'7" wingspan and 6'6" with a 6'9" wingspan, and they should make a huge jump defensively with George Hill and Dante Exum at point guard. How much does that impact a defense?
Well, I mean, this was one of the questions we wanted to ask about the Jazz going into last season and maybe never really got the opportunity to ask it because of Exum's injury, which is, you know, when they improved so much in the second half of the season, how much of that could be credited to, you know, the fact that they were understanding Quinn Snyder's system better in the second half of the season? How much of it could be attributed to losing Enes Kanter?
Yeah.
How much of it could be attributed to Rudy Gobert starting? And then how much of it could be attributed to the fact that Dante Exum embraces the starting point guard and gave them great size at that position, which, you know, I think is definitely one of the factors there. So I don't know if I can give you an answer as to how important that is, but it's definitely important.
If you were to build your perfect defensive team, what's the first player you would add?
I still do think it probably would be, you know, if there was like eight of us drafting teams to build the best defenses possible, it probably still would be a center, but I'd have to look at basically the depth at that position, whether, you know, the drop off from the best center to the fifth best center would be as large as the drop off from Kawhi. Kawhi was my defensive player of the year pick last year. He would have been my defensive player of the year pick 2 years ago if he had just played more minutes. You know, because he had injuries that year. So I guess this is a disingenuous answer, and my answer would be Kawhi.
Because it's really interesting, right? I mean, I understand where you're taking it. I don't mean to take it back there, but Spurs, Duncan was somewhat of – it was a rim protector, but not – I mean, right, he wasn't playing a ton. Atlanta didn't have a rim protector. Indiana did. Boston didn't. Golden State did in Bogut, but he didn't play a ton. Clippers did.
And didn't Draymond Green.
Huh?
And didn't Draymond Green. His rim protection numbers were outstanding last year.
And those are the best defensive teams in the NBA last year. It's an interesting, right? I think it's fair to say this, you don't have to have a rim protector to be elite defensively. And I really think Atlanta last year did, and Boston probably, they did some interesting things last year defensively, particularly Atlanta. You know, Atlanta in the second half of the season, I think, was better defensively than San Antonio.
Yeah, sounds right. Yeah, I mean, and they really did it with a lot of mobility. I mean, I guess the other question here is, you know, how much is this evolving or maybe even oscillating over the time? Because, you know, you go back 4 or 5 years ago, there was this notion that centers are being phased out defensively and, you know, we want interchangeable defenders. And then all of a sudden, Roy Hibbert started to figure out that verticality was in the NBA rulebook, and he and the Pacers coaching staff started working on that every day. And all of a sudden, everyone was like, wow, look at the value of a rim protecting big man, especially because Frank Vogel in Indiana were able to build around that skill to say, we are not going to be afraid to close out hard and take away three-pointers because we know we've got big fella at the rim who's going to protect us if we get beat off the dribble. And therefore, we can build a defense that is designed to force as many mid-range jumpers as possible. So that was kind of the big moment, and now center takes paramount importance again. And then now the next evolution of that is, well, all of a sudden teams have gotten, you know, centers have started shooting threes. Atlanta really did this the other way, by the way, with Peril Antich in 2013 in the playoffs against Indiana, the year that the Pacers were the first seed and the Hawks were the eighth seed in that series with seven. And they were able to take Hibbert out of the paint in that series and really neutralize him. And that was kind of the canary in the coal mine, that you also need to have the mobility to defend on the perimeter. But now you look at kind of who the ideal defender is, and it's probably a guy like Karl Anthony Towns who can protect on the rim or protect the rim, but also has the athleticism to go out and defend on the perimeter.
All right, before I let you go, you did a piece on 2017's most likely new NBA All-Stars, which is a really hard thing to be, by the way. Like, everyone always, is so-and-so going to be an All-Star? I'm like, no, no chance. And they're like, what do you mean by no chance? Like, it's 12 players from the conference. It's even less than that, really, I think. What is the All-Star roster now, 10?
No, it's still 12.
12. It should be 15, by the way.
Yes.
But it's 12. I mean, like, it's a crazy, crazy hard thing to be. So who did you project as new All-Stars? And to some extent, I guess it also means that someone has to no longer be an All-Star.
Well, Kobe is leaving the West team, so we know we got one spot to play with.
All right. And who else doesn't make the All-Star team?
Maybe LaMarcus Aldridge. Maybe this is the year. I don't know that I thought he was really an All-Star last year in his first year in San Antonio.
Okay, but I know as a Seattle-based Washington Husky, you can't say this, but is Isaiah Thomas really an All-Star again?
Well, I mean, if Boston's second or third in the East, they're probably going to have at least one and maybe two All-Stars. So, it's him and Al Horford and Jay Crowder competing for those spots. But yes.
I knew you couldn't go there. Okay. I knew that was too hard for you. All right. So, who did you, I mean, I want to make this clear. I like the project you're on. To list 10 potential All-Stars is kind of crazy, since what do we come up with? We think there's going to be Pau Gasol was an All-Star. He's no longer going to be an All-Star in the East, right?
Although he was an injury replacement.
Okay, but he was an injury replacement for Chris Bosh, who maybe not be an All-Star.
Technically, Horford was his injury replacement. Oh, okay. Gasol replaced Butler.
Okay, I'm sorry. My bad.
I've done a lot of research on this.
All right, so we think there's a chance for one or two Eastern Conference spots to be open. Who are the most likely Eastern Conference guys to fill those spots?
So to me, there's really one guy in each conference that stands out. In the East, it's Giannis, who, if he comes close to what he did last year in the second half of the season with all those triple-doubles playing point guard, will probably be an All-Star, particularly if Milwaukee is around 500 in the playoff mix, which I think that they may be.
All right. And in the West, Kobe's gone. Let's say that DeMarcus Cousins destroys yet another franchise and the coaches get tired of voting for him. LaMarcus doesn't make it. And so there's three spots, maybe even an injury replacement. So you could have the DeMarcus and LaMarcus seemed unlikely, but let's just, all right. So you could have two or three Western Conference spots. Who are your guys there?
So I think Towns is by far the most likely guy to segue off of the previous question. I mean, just Minnesota's likelihood of leaping and then what he did where, you could make a case that he was one of the three or four best centers in the league by the end of his rookie season. In year two, I think he's probably going to start getting that accolade and not stop for at least a decade here. And then some other interesting options, I think, the Jazz guys are in the mix. If the Jazz are as good as we've talked about them being with their RPM projection, they're going to get an All-Star. Coaches are going to reward them with an All-Star. It's just a question of who they decide to vote for out of Hayward, Favors, and Gobert.
It's interesting. It's a good piece, by the way. I don't want to give it away. It's part of the reason I'm limiting. Kevin lists 10 prospective All-Stars, and then actually what I thought was really interesting was the next five who were the honorable mention. So check that out. It's available at ESPN.com. Kevin Pelton, we love you. You're fabulous. Another enjoyable afternoon of chatting basketball with you, my good friend.
It always is.
That is Kevin Pelton. If you could take a moment in our Locked On traditions and send a thank you to @KPelton for his time today, I would greatly appreciate that. Also, check out the rest of the Locked On Podcast Network. Just about everyone's up right now on the NBA teams. There's a few that have to be finished up, but if you haven't found your team yet, make sure you subscribe on iTunes to your team's Locked On Podcast Network. And thanks a ton to all the people that have been sponsoring our programs. Larson Digital Media, Mack Weldon, Casper Mattresses, SeatGeek, all of them that have been out there being so great. University of Utah Online MBA program have been so supportive to us. We're so appreciative of it. Thank you so much for listening.